Yeah, Fletch said grimly. Thanks. We can get married Saturday, we can have a honeymoon, and maybe you'll even have a job when we get back. That's right. Cindy had stopped laughing. She was looking at Fletch with new eyes. You're a reporter. Fletch sighed. Right. For the Chronicle Gazette, said Cindy. For the News Tribune. Fletch looked a dagger at Barbara. What's going on? Barbara asked. Cool, said Cindy. That explains everything. Fletch said, I'm afraid it does. Have you written anything for the newspaper I might have read? Cindy asked. Sunday, Fletch said. Did you read Sports Freaks at End of Line? Yeah, Cindy said. Sure I did. The lead piece in the sports section. Real good. Did you write that? Fletch said, just the headline. Oh. What were you doing? Barbara grinned gamely, as if asking to be let in on a joke she might have already ruined. Being undercover? Thanks for asking, Fletch said. Cindy began laughing again. She clapped her hands. Super! Super, Fletch quoted grimly. The waiter gave the bill to Fletch. Serving you, sir, said the waiter, is an affliction I'd hate to have become an addiction. Fletch stared at him. Cindy took the bill. No, this is on the company, remember? She laughed out loud again. You might say it's on the house. Anyway, Cindy, Barbara said, we're going to be married on a bluff overlooking the ocean. Did I tell you that? The weather's supposed to be nice Saturday. Cindy was paying the bill in cash. Remember, we're having dinner with my mother tonight, Barbara said uncertainly to Fletch. Tonight for dinner, Fletch said somberly, I'm having my head on a plate. Cindy, Barbara said, around the corner there's a sports shop. There's this great-looking skiing suit in the window, you know, for our honeymoon. Want to walk over with me and see how I look in it? Sure, Cindy said. She left the waiter a generous tip. The two women stood up from the table. Fletch remained, elbow on the table, chin in his hand. See you, Fletch, Barbara said. Fletch didn't answer. Cindy said happily, See you, Fletch, at the wedding, Saturday. After Cindy had gone a few paces, she turned around, again doubled over in laughter. Fletch, she called, you're being married on a bluff. Chapter 24. Hello? Hello? Fletch knocked loudly on the frame of the screen door. Inside the bungalow, a television was playing loudly, but nevertheless was drowned out by a child crying, other children yelling, and the noise of some mechanical toy. Hello? He shouted. The front porch was a junkyard of broken toys, a scooter with its neck twisted, a crunched tricycle, a flattened plastic doll, a play stove that looked like it had been assaulted with an axe. On the television, a woman's voice said, If you tell Ed what you know about me, Mary, I'll see you rot in hell. Inside the house, a woman's voice shouted, Keep up that ballin', Ronnie, and I'll slap you silly. A man's voice said, Now, let's get this eating process completed. The kiddies must eat, Nancy. Keep up their strength. Associate Professor Thomas Farley's bungalow was 8 blocks from the edge of the university campus. Other humble houses surrounding it had vestiges of paint on them and at least undisturbed stands of weeds in their front gardens. Farley's house was yellow and gray with rot. The front window was smashed in its center, and the front yard was packed dirt, holding, among other things, a wheelless, collapsed, rusted yellow Volkswagen. Driving to Farley's house, Fletch had heard a repeat of the radio news report Barbara had mentioned. Stuart Childers had confessed to murdering Donald Haybeck. He had confessed and been released. Fletch stood as close to the screen door as he could and shouted as loudly as he could, Hey! Hello! Noise within the house dimmed fractionally. A shadow the other side of the screen door grew into a woman who said, Who are you? Fletcher. Who? I don't know you. Better come in. Inside it was discovered that it was not the screen door which made him less audible. Are you a student? The woman asked. I'm from the News Tribune, the paper. Tom's back here, she said. I don't know if he's corrected your paper yet. She led him into the kitchen at the back of the house. You said your name is Terhune? The house smelled of diapers, burnt food, spilled milk, and ordinary household dirt. "I'm from the newspaper," Fletch said. In the kitchen, beside the blaring television set, a battery-operated toy tank treading noisily along the floor, up and down piles of laundry, garbage, and books, were five children, all of whom seemed to be under the age of 7. 2 were in diapers, 3 in underpants. Each seemed to have been freshly bathed that morning and used dishwater. A short, bald, chubby man was at the chipped kitchen table, spooning mushed prunes into an infant in a high chair. The man's eyes, visible as he glanced up at Fletch for a brief instant, were startlingly pale blue. 4 of the children also had light blue eyes, but none as light as his. The woman said something.
"What?"
Fletch asked. The television said, "Transporting a cargo of dum-dum bullets." The woman turned it down, which left just the noises of the tank overcoming all obstacles on the floor, 2 children shouting and kicking each other, and 1 small child sitting on a torn cushion against the wall, bawling lustily.
"Ronnie," the woman said to the bawling child, "stop crying or I'll kick you in the mouth."
Her threat went unheeded. Her feet were bare.
"Do you have a car?" the woman asked Fletch.
"Yes. Are you Nancy Farley?"
"He wants to see you," the man at the table said.
"I'm sure he wants to see you, Tom. Something about a paper."
"I want to see you, Nancy. I'm from a newspaper."
"Oh," she said, "about my father's death."
She was wearing a loose, bleach-stained skirt and a green, food-stained blouse. Her arms and legs were thin and white, her stomach distended. Her hair hung in greasy strands.
"I don't care to say anything about that, but I do need a ride."
"I'll give you a ride."
"Our car is broken," the man at the table said. "Smashed, kaput, ruined."
"I should have gone yesterday," Nancy said.
"Yes, yes," the man said. "Bobby like 'em prunes."
"Sit down." Nancy picked up a pile of newspapers and a telephone book from another chair at the table and dropped them on the floor.
"I'll just change." She looked down at her clothes. "Tom, should I change?"
The child on the cushion stopped bawling. Determination entered his face.
"Never change, darling."
The determined-looking child got up from his cushion. He crossed the floor. He caught the tank and picked it up. He hurled it through the window. Now 3 children were in the middle of the floor, shouting and flailing each other. Hair pulling seemed their best strategic device. It caused the best shrieks.
"I'll just change," Nancy said.
Fletch looked through the kitchen window. In the yard, the toy tank was assaulting a collapsed baby carriage. He sat down.
"Choo, choo, 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 choo," said Tom Farley. "Now the choo-choo comes to the open tunnel. Open the tunnel."
The baby opened her mouth. Tom stuck the mushed prunes into it.
"Now," he said, scraping the bottom of the jar clean. "Choo, choo, choo, choo."
"Social Security," Fletch quoted. "The sidewalks of the city offer up without pity little old ladies to be mugged."
"Ah."
Tom wiped the baby's mouth gently with a crusted rag.
"You're familiar with my work."
"Do you call it the poetry of violence?"
"That's what it's called."
Tom lifted the baby from the high chair and placed her carefully on the floor. He crossed the kitchen to where an even smaller baby was lying in a plastic basket chair on the edge of the stove, looking like something to be roasted. The man was shaped like a rutabaga. He brought the baby in the basket chair to the kitchen table.
"Your poetry is different," Fletch said.
"Different, yes."
Tom was trying to unscrew the cap off a bottle of baby formula.
"Why don't you call it beautiful?"
He handed the bottle to Fletch, who unscrewed the cap and handed it back.
"Would beautiful be the right word?" Fletch asked.
"Why not?"
Tom screwed a nipple onto the bottle.
"Choo, choo, choo."
The baby opened his mouth. Tom inserted the bottle.
"There must be a beauty in violence. People are so attracted to it."
Holding the bottle tipped to the infant's mouth, he looked down at where 4 children now fought and cried on the floor. 1 was bleeding from a scratch on an arm. Another had a new welt over an eye.
"That's why I have so many children," Tom Farley said. "Look at their fury. Isn't it wonderful? Unbridled violence. I can hardly wait until this crop get to be teenagers."
"May your dreams come true," Fletch prayed. "How many do you think will make it?"
"You are attracted to violence," Tom said. Not really.
Do you watch football?
Yes.
Do you watch boxing?
Yes.
They aren't violent?
Tom's hands were the softest, pudgiest Fletch had ever seen on a man.
The vast preponderance of human entertainment is violent.
He nodded at the television.
That instrument of popular human communication dispenses more violence in a day than most humans, without television, normally would see in a lifetime. What attracts us to such violence?
Fascination, said Fletch.
It is the second greatest puzzle in life that people are willing to do unto others violence which, apparently, they want done unto themselves.
Beauty, Tom said.
The fascinating beauty of violence. The ultimate irony. Why has there never been a poet before to admit it?
Slim, belted hips, sprayed across by automatic fire, each bullet ripping through, lifting, throwing back, kicking the body at its center. Thus the warrior in perfection bows to his death, twists, pivots, and falls, quoted Fletch.
Beautiful, said Tom.
I have seen such things, said Fletch.
And it is beautiful. Admit it.
Tom Farley tipped the baby bottle higher.
Wasted. He is wasted, but not wasted. This death is his life, and he is perfect in it.
What courses do you teach at the university?
The works of Geoffrey Chaucer, another course comparing the works of John Dryden and Edmund Spenser, also my share of freshman English courses.
You teach the Fairy Queen?
Oh, yes.
Tom took the bottle out of the baby's mouth. There was a small quantity of formula left in it. He put it to his own mouth and drank it. The baby cried. Tom took the bottle to the sink and rinsed it.
Fletch asked,
Did you do violence to your father-in-law?
Yes, Tom said. I married his daughter. He never forgave either of us.
He never came to see his grandchildren?
No, I doubt he knew how many he had or their names. Too bad. He would have appreciated them.
Fletch watched one Farley child throw a carrot at the head of another.
I think so.
There was no honesty in Donald Haybeck.
You're living in squalor here, said Fletch. Your father-in-law was a multimillionaire.
Did I murder my father-in-law?
The short, pudgy man turned around from the kitchen sink and dried his hands on a piece of newspaper.
There would have been no irony in it.
No?
No. It's the innocence of victims which makes a poetry of what happens to them. And I'm a poet.
Did you know he intended to give almost his entire fortune to a museum?
No.
If he had died without a will, as I understand lawyers are apt to do, your wife might have inherited enough for you to take up poetry full-time. That is, if his fortune were still intact. Are you saying poets aren't practical people?
Some are.
Tom Farley smiled.
Those who get published in the Atlantic and win the Pulitzer Prize. They might be practical enough to do murder. But surely you're not accusing the most unpopular published poet in the country of practicality.
Nancy Farley re-entered the room. She was wearing ballet slippers, a hotter-looking full skirt, and a once-white blouse gray from repeated washing. An effort had been made to brush her hair.
"Are we ready to go?" she asked.
Not knowing where he was going, Fletch stood up.
"Morton Rickmers, the book editor of the News Tribune, might like to do an interview with you, Mr. Farley. Would you be available to him?"
"See?" Tom Farley grinned at his wife. "I'm reaping the benefits of my father-in-law's sensational murder already."
To Fletch, he said, "Sure, I'm available to him. I'd do anything to deepen my unpopularity."
Chapter 25.
"Is it all right to leave him with the children?"
Fletch buckled himself into the driver's seat.
"Why do you ask?"
Nancy Farley found her seatbelt.
"Your husband sees beauty and violence. Those kids are beating up on each other in front of him."
"He's better with the kids than I am. He has much more patience."
"Much more tolerance."
He turned the ignition key.
"Where are we going?"
"The monastery of St. Thomas in Tomasito."
"Tomasito?" Fletch looked at her. "That's 100 kilometers from here."
"Yes," she said, "it is."
"I thought I was just dropping you off downtown."
"My brother is in the monastery."
Nancy stared at the unmoving landscape through the windshield.
"It is a cloistered monastery. I don't think he yet knows Father is dead. I feel I must go talk to him. I have no other way to get there." Your brother is a monk? A monk, a monk, she said. I suppose Tom could make a vicious nursery rhyme from that. A monk, hiding in a trunk to have nothing to do with his father the punk. Not very good.
Not very.
I guess I'll leave poetry to my husband. I'll just keep birthing his little monsters.
Fletch put the car in gear.
Sorry, he said, there's a hole in the muffler.
I don't hear it.
Are you a Christian?
Me?
God, no. Bob's going into the monastery was his own thing. It had nothing to do with the family, I mean our upbringing at all. I suspect he's trying to atone for the sins of his father. Aren't they supposed to be visited on the sons? He's got his job cut out for him.
Across from the university, Fletch drove up the ramp to the freeway and accelerated.
He said, "Someone who talked with your father just last week told me your father said he intended to enter a monastery."
Nancy gasped.
"My father?"
She laughed. "I knew newspapers print nothing but fiction."
"It's true," Fletch said. "At least it's true that somebody said it." "Maybe my father would enter a monastery if he heard the Judgment Day horn. It would be just like him. A clever legal defense."
"He was getting older."
"Not that old, about 60.
"Perhaps he wasn't well?"
"Hope so. If anyone deserved leprosy of the gizzard, he did."
"Were you never close?"
"Emotionally? I don't know. I never saw him that much growing up. Black suit and black shoes coming and going in the driveway. Intellectually? After I grew up, I realized how he'd been screwing the system all his life. A real destroyer of values. For profit. He never believed in good or evil or justice, any of the things we have to believe in to center our lives, to focus. He believed in having his own way, despite the social consequences, in lining his own pockets. He was the most completely asocial and amoral man I ever knew. If he weren't educated as a lawyer, he probably would have been a psychopathic killer himself.
After a moment, she laughed wryly.
"My father, a monk."
"Your husband," Fletch said, "extols violence."
"You don't see a difference?" Nancy asked. "My husband is a teacher, a poet. At sacrifice to himself, he's pointing out the beauty in violence, and there is beauty in violence. We are attracted to it. He's making us confront the violence in ourselves. He's teaching us about ourselves. His poetry wouldn't be so damned effective if it weren't true."
"What sacrifice to himself?"
"Come on. People cross the street when they see him coming. They won't even talk to me. We haven't been invited to a faculty cocktail party in 3 years. Most of the faculty want to get rid of him. He could never get another job teaching. We're going to end up in Starvation Lane, just so Tom can make this statement, not about the nature of violence, but about the nature of you and me. Don't you understand?"
"Anyway," Fletch stretched in his car seat,
"this man who should know told me your father intended to give $5 million to the museum. The money was going to be spent on contemporary religious art. He was going to give the rest of his worldly goods to a monastery, which he was going to enter."
Nancy shrugged.
"He had an angle somewhere. I'd guess someone had the goods on him. The Justice Department, the Internal Revenue Service, the American Bar Association. I expect that after the dust settled, you would have found my father living luxuriously somewhere with his sexy, pea-brained young wife behind the facade, the protection of some religious or cultural foundation, all brilliantly legally established and funded by himself."
"Maybe. But did you know your father had stated the intention of disposing of his worldly goods?"
"I read something of the sort in the newspaper. This morning's newspaper, after he was murdered."
"No one had told you before?"
"No."
Fletch said, "It's always hard to prove that you don't know something."
They rode without speaking for a while. They listened to the Grateful Dead on the radio. Finally, Fletch said, "At your father's house yesterday, I met a woman who was about 60 years old, white-haired or blue-haired, whatever you want to call it, wearing a colorful dress and green sneakers. I asked her if she was Mrs. Haybeck, and she said she was. All she'd say about your father was that he wore black shoes and wandered away. She referred to Haybeck, Harrison, and Holler as Hey-Ha-Haw."
Nancy said. "That your mother?"
Nancy shifted in her seat. "What it says on your shorts is correct. You can be a friend, I guess."
"Now, that's not quite what the legend means."
Fletch had changed T-shirts.
He had hoped his own pure T-shirt left outside his shorts would cover the advertisements.
"You put your finger on it," Nancy said. "Growing up, my father and I ignored each other. He wasn't interesting. When I got older, I learned contempt for him. Brilliant legal practitioner. Bullshit. He was a crook. When he put Mother away, had her legally committed to a home for the mentally unwell, I absolutely despised him. I never spoke to him again or voluntarily saw him again. Sorry, I didn't tell the exact truth before. I hate the son of a bitch."
"Oh."
"Mother didn't need to be thrown out of her home, confined to an institution, however swank and gentle. She's just pixelated."
Fletch remembered Mrs. Habeck looking down at her green sneakers and saying, "I don't have any privacy."
"Pixelated," Nancy repeated. "Year after year, Dad left her alone in that house. No one wanted to know her. At first she tried to get out, go do things, you know, join the flower club. The other ladies didn't want her. Some sensational case of my father's would be in the newspaper, a small editorial outcry about Donald Habeck getting a not guilty verdict for some rapist. And Mother's flower arrangements wouldn't get into the show. Her phone wouldn't ring. Once when I was a teenager and getting independent, Mother marched downtown and got herself a job behind the counter in a florist's shop. My father put a stop to that quick enough. Poor damned soul. She moldered alone in that house, talked to herself. She began setting the dining room table for luncheon and dinner parties for 6 people, 8 people, 12. There were no people."
Tears streamed down Nancy's face. Her voice sounded dry.
"What could I do? I went home as much as possible. She used to go to 6 different hairdressers in one day, just to have people to talk to. Her hair was getting burned out. Then she took to spending all day in the shopping malls, buying everything in the world, lawnmowers, washing machines, towels. There were about 20 washing machines delivered to the house one week. When she was being packed up to go to the Agnes Whitaker home, it was discovered she had over 2,000 pairs of shoes. She liked to talk to the salespeople, you see."
Fletch took the turning for Tomasito.
"Does she escape from the home often?"
"Almost every day. At first, the institution staff would be alarmed and call me, I suppose call my father. Scold her when she came back. But she's harmless. She has no money, no credit cards. I have no idea how she gets around. I've never been able to figure that out. On nice days, I guess she goes and sits in the park, walks around the stores pretending she's buying things, goes back to her old home and sits by the pool."
"Yeah, that's where she was yesterday."
"She must appear to Jasmine as sort of the ghost of the first wife."
Nancy laughed.
"So what? She turns up at my house 2 or 3 times a week, sits and watches the television, sits and watches the children. Tells some absolutely crazy things, like about the time she made friends with a great black bear in the woods and the bear taught her how to fish. The children adore her."
"And she loves the children?"
"How do I know? She keeps showing up."
"And you don't think this woman should have been confined?"
Nancy's jaw tightened.
"I don't think she should have been left in isolation for years. I don't think she should have been socially ostracized. No, I don't think she should have been thrown out of her home. When strange symptoms began appearing, I don't think my father needed to continue what he was doing. They could have retired, started another life somewhere. Or, if it was too late, some sort of a paid housekeeper nurse could have been hired to stay with her, give her some company."
Nancy was silent for a long moment, the muscles in her jaw working. Then she said,
"My father got rid of her through some legal trickery, divorce and confinement, because he wanted to marry pea-brained Jasmine."
"You don't like Jasmine, of course."
"Like her?"
Nancy looked across the car at Fletch.
"I feel sorry for her. The same thing is happening to her as happened to my mother."
They went down a ramp from the freeway onto a 2-lane road through fairly decent farmland. Nancy said,
"I heard on the television this morning that someone confessed to my father's murder."
"Yes," Fletch said, "Stuart Childers, a client of your father's, accused of murdering his brother, acquitted 2 or 3 months ago."
"So?" Nancy said.
"He was released by the police immediately. I don't know why."
Nancy said, "What are you getting at, friend?"
"I don't think it was a gangland slaying," Fletch said, "despite the suggestion in this morning's News Tribune."
"You think I did it?"
Someone in the family heard your father intended, or said he intended, to dispose of all his worldly goods, for reasons sacred or profane. Incidentally, my source reported that your father said last week that no one gave a tin whistle for him. His words. Nancy snorted. I suppose that's true. Someone decided to do him in before he decided to do the family out. You, your husband, your mother, for your sake or the sake of your kids, your father's second wife. You don't understand Tom. He may be the important poet, the intellectual you say he is, but where was he Monday morning? At the university. What time is his first class on Mondays? Nancy hesitated. 2 p.m. Okay. Poverty is important to Tom. The fact that he, his work, is being scorned, it makes the sacrifice more real, the poetry, she stuttered, more significant, monumental. You weren't brought up in squalor, Fletch said. Your daddy may not have bounced you on his knee, but you had a stocked refrigerator and a clean home, with a swimming pool in the garden, plus a lot of washing machines. Frankly, friend, I don't want a penny from my father. People are still getting mugged, raped, and murdered because my father took their money. Ah, the beauty of violence, Fletch said. You've got 5 kids crawling around the floor. You said you are headed for Starvation Lane. Not many mothers let their kids starve if there's an alternative. After a moment, Nancy said, Monday morning, I was home alone with the kids. Great witnesses. Got any other? No. Fletch slowed as they passed a sign saying the Monastery of St. Thomas. He turned right through the gates. There's a guard at the gates to the News Tribune parking lot, he said, checking cars. I see someone, knowing your father was going to the newspaper that morning to arrange for the announcement of his giving away his fortune, walking into the parking lot, shooting him as he was getting out of his car at the back of the lot, and walking out again unquestioned. The car was rising on the road through a well-kept forest. Who, Mother? She does have her own way of coming and going, Fletch said, and her own point of view. And what does she have to lose? She's already been committed as insane. You haven't mentioned Jasmine. I haven't met Jasmine. By the way, your father has a cook now. Good. Jasmine has someone to talk to. I doubt she can fry eggs. A young wife, possibly about to be left high and dry through her husband's spiritual conversion or his legal trickery. Atop a gardened knoll ahead of them was a large, stuccoed Spanish-style building. Tom's self-image would be destroyed by our having money, Nancy said. My mother couldn't focus on anything long enough to do murder. I don't care enough about my father or his money to have murdered him. And then there's Robert. Fletch put the car in the gravel car park and turned off the engine. Now you're really crazy. I'll wait here for you. Her hand on the car doorknob, Nancy didn't move. Again, she stared through the windshield at unmoving scenery. I'm sorry for you, Fletch said. This will be tough on both of you. I'll be here. No, Nancy said. Come with me, will you, friend? This place gives me the creeps.